Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. The Middle Corridor trade route has become much more important since Russia launched its full-scale war in Ukraine. The European Union responded to Russian invasion by imposing sanctions on Russia, including on goods transiting Russian territory, necessitating use of alternate routes. The Middle Corridor connects Europe to Asia through the Caucasus and Central Asia. However, while basic infrastructure of the Middle Corridor was in place in Central Asia, replacing Russia as a trade route requires substantial work on the road and railway systems and ports in Central Asia. On January 29th and 30th, there was an investors forum for EU Central Asia transport connectivity in Brussels, where it was announced European and international investors would commit some 10 billion euros in support and investments toward transport connectivity between Europe and Central Asia as part of the EU's global gateway trade network. It's a major boost in expanding the middle corridor in Central Asia. And to discuss all this, I am joined by Samuel Dovary Vesterby, Director of the European Neighborhood Council and Master of Ceremonies, if I may, at the Brussels Forum this week, and Kęstutis Jankauskas, the EU Ambassador to Kazakhstan. And thank you both for joining me. Samuel, I'd like to start with you. Could you give us some of the basic facts, details about what was discussed at the investment forum in Brussels this week? What is all that money going toward?
Well, brief historical context might be due in the sense that the investors forum, which took place Monday, Tuesday this week, is a follow-up to the Global Gateway Conference, which took place in October last year. And it was very much, in the beginning, an attempt to drum up investments from the private sector. And it became successfully so, as we saw this week. Before the investors forum, there, of course, was speculation to the degree to which the EU would be able to attract investment banks, EIB, European Bank for Reconstruction and Development funds, private sector funds, both from the region as well from the member states. And so there was a lot of question marks as to whether this EU strategy would really attract enough business. And I would have to say that this week very much proved that it did. There was perhaps one of the important announcements was this essentially package of 1.5 billion euros signed with Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and I believe Kyrgyzstan as well on connectivity, and it's supported by the Kazakhstan Development Bank and also supported by the investment banks. And as a result, we saw what was initially a strategy or initiative materialize in actual economic terms, in terms of investments. And I think maybe we'll discuss this more afterwards, but it's relevant in the sense that there is this buzzword in the EU, which they, is known as blending. This concept blending is a typical EU bureaucratic lingo. And I say that in a polite and positive way, but it's, of course, a very important concept because it means, you know, the EU comes out and puts some funds and some guarantees, and then it goes to the private sector and says, do you want to top up on this money and add in yours as well? And goes to the investment banks and says, would you like to add your investments and your money as well? And it's a very unique way of financing infrastructure and connectivity and transport, because compared to, for example, the Belt and Road Initiative, it doesn't have that component. It's much more government run. There's a, you know, government official and some very government linked banks that tell you, okay, we're going to put in this money. We don't need to, you know, create too much consensus about it. We don't need to go and actually attract business and do impact assessment and see if it's going to make us a bunch of money and if it's going to be sustainable, environmentally friendly and reliable, which is very top down. Well, the Global Gateway Initiative and the Investors Forum is very much the opposite of that. And I think that's the reason why this morning when we had discussions with all the Central Asian ambassadors, including the Tajik ambassador to the EU, the Tajik ambassador specifically says the EU is one among many actors investing in Central Asia, but it's by far the most reliable one.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Yankauskas, I want to bring you in for a second. Can you talk a little bit about Kazakhstan's role in Global Gateway? I mean, we know that Kazakhstan is a key country in the Middle Corridor. It's the only Central Asian country, of course, that borders China on one side and the Caspian Sea on the other. What is Kazakhstan's contribution to this?
First of all, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. And indeed, the last two days of the Investors Forum in Brussels was quite an event. The first of that kind, but I believe it's not the last one because now the work is only starting and we will see more of events like that, exactly bringing institutions, governments, and the private sector, possible potential private investors. Now, Kazakhstan, I think many of our listeners know or have heard the name of Kazakhstan. It's the ninth biggest country, the biggest in Central Asia. And maybe not many know that part, a small part of Kazakhstan, but rather large part of its territory is in the geographical Europe. So geographically, actually, it's similar to Turkey, Turkey. And it bridges European Union, South Caucasus with Central Asia and Asia, China. So in a way, Kazakhstan is the biggest landmass there in the middle. And it's crucial for European Union to Asia, European Union to China, and to Central Asia for the connectivity. Kazakhstan was always playing an important role in the region, being a regional leader, being a global player, being open for European businesses and investments, because now in the country, European Union is the biggest investor and European Union is Kazakhstan's biggest trading partner. That partnership was mainly focusing on energy and oil, which is still an important part. But now when the two countries, usually the northern route, that's the one crossing Russia and Belarus, is now under sanctions. Then the southern, if you look kind of going south through Iran, Iran is also a country under sanctions. So that leaves us with rather kind of small corridor. That's why we call it a Trans-Caspian, or some call it a middle corridor. It is an important way, free of sanctions, crossing Turkey and the Black Sea, South Caucasus countries, Caspian Sea, and the Central Asia. And Kazakhstan there is the biggest actor with two ports, which are now kind of starting to develop really fast. Because, years before, the northern route was always trying to be cheapest and fastest. Now, with the sanctions there in place, and probably the sanctions will be there for quite some time, that's the time for this middle corridor or Trans-Caspian route to really pick up. For that, it is important for us. It's important for our partners in Central Asia and in Asia. But we need all to work together. There are several actors that need to align the efforts and work together. And that's part of this Global Gateways, our outreach. And that was part what we tried to bridge all of this at the Investors Forum, because our South Caucasus partners, Turkey, was also invited there.
Okay, thank you. And before I get on to some of the projects, let me ask you one more question, Ambassador. Samuel had mentioned that it's a blend, right? That they're looking for investment from all kinds of different partners, as well as the money that's coming from governments. Kazakhstan, a Kazakh bank actually was one of the signatories to one of these new agreements. Can you talk about Kazakhstan's financial participation in Global Gateway projects?
Absolutely. Kazakhstan is the middle income country. It's been there for quite some time. So frankly, that country is in a way self-sufficient. It was not in the need of, let's say, so much of the Chinese investments and loans. It's self-sufficient. It has the pretty well-established sovereign wealth fund. Then it's the big, basically the infrastructure there, the railways, ports, are in the hands of the well-run state company called Kazakh Railways. Then if you look into some of the most recent investments, they're now building one additional railway line from the Chinese-Kazakh border till the middle of the country. They're opening the third crossing point with China on the border, kind of the most northern crossing point. The build of the bypass via Almaty to increase the speed of transportation. This is all basically done by Kazakhstan itself, with some help primarily by a European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. So Kazakhstan is now also trying to play a bigger role with its own development bank, becoming also a donor in a way on the world markets for the countries that that need assistance, for example, Afghanistan. So Kazakhstan has always played that that important role. But the study which the European Commission did together with the EBRD last year showed that there are much more investments needed for this route to really pick up. So it's likely that also Kazakhstan will not be able to develop all of that infrastructure itself, and they will need some of the assistance. Now, as Samuel said, EU is doing this blending. And blending means that sometimes we do the grants, like we funded the study, EBRD study, which became the basis. Then some other banks, World Bank produced its own study. Asian Development Bank did also some additional research into kind of fundability aspects of the transportation. Then what happened in the Investors Forum, we tried to attract our international financial institutions. So European Investment Bank, EBRD, World Bank, ADB, they come with loans with good conditions, borrowing conditions. And also international projects bring that element of supervision and transparency into these projects, which is also important and gives the assurance to likely future private investors that these projects will be run according to the world standards. And then what European institutions can do, they can provide the guarantees for private investors that are also going to come, hopefully, more in kind of in the bigger numbers to various of these projects. EBRD study identified several infrastructure bottlenecks and also the soft connectivity bottlenecks, like management of different procedures and digitalization. So that all needs investment. At in Brussels now, we looked at the lowest hanging fruits, the most bankable and manageable projects, which would be the fastest solutions to increase the speed, reliability, predictability for containers moving along this route. More hopefully to come.
Okay, great. Thank you. Samuel, I know there's a lot of projects that are involved in this. I believe it was 33 hard infrastructure projects and 7 soft infrastructure projects. But can you kind of give us an idea of what are the priority projects? What are the first projects this money is going to be directed toward?
Well, as you correctly mentioned, there are many, many projects, and we're talking about, you know, billions and billions of euros in funding. So there's a vast array of different projects, and there's a vast array of private sector investment and interest. And what we saw already back in October last year at the Global Gateway Conference is that there were many, many memorandums of understanding signed on everything from critical raw materials to road and infrastructure. So the plethora is pretty wide. But if you ask me what are the two perhaps most important, or at least from my perspective, most interesting flagship projects which I would raise to your audience, I would probably say that one of them, a Swedish-German energy investment in Kazakhstan, which is building green hydrogen. So it's an energy project in Kazakhstan with EU funding. And the logic behind it is, of course, that it's a massive multi-billion investment project that allows, number one, for Central Asian energy consumption of a renewable kind that's cheap and that's reliable and that's in some ways autonomous, because it's renewable energy. The Central Asian, especially the Kazakhs, would not be dependent on others. And they would be able to use that energy for their own populations, as well as for industry in the region, as well as potentially for any other investors in supply chains and industrial investments in the region. So I think that Swedish-German green hydrogen project, which has EU support, is a very, very important flagship project in the case of Kazakhstan. And then I think the second one that is also, I think, of equal importance and of similar economic, energy, strategic thinking is the investment into the hydroelectric Rogun Dam in Tajikistan, which, if I'm not mistaken, is scheduled to be the highest dam in the world. And this project is equally interesting because it of course has the hydroelectric renewable energy component and the similar logic as I just explained vis-a-vis the hydrogen, green hydrogen plant in Kazakhstan, but it has an additional element, and the additional element is water management, because for people, it is a small sidetrack, but for people who know Central Asia, the concept of climate change difficulties and water scarcity and water management are very, very important, because it's a region which suffers from lack of water, and the potential, the scarcity of water has the potential of deeply impacting agriculture, which in turn impacts food security, which in turn impacts even things like the textile industry and agricultural textile garment apparel industry, which is very, very important in, for example, a country like Uzbekistan, that is a more of a net importer of water compared to Tajikistan, which is a more mountainous area, and hence it's an exporter of water, let's say. So there's also this kind of climate change, water scarcity, water management component, which is very, very important. And I think, but we can also, of course, ask Ambassador Jan Kauskas about this, but I think that's one of the strategic reasoning behind also the EU support of these two very important flagship projects.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Jan Kauskas, your comments?
Yes, Samuel is absolutely right. Water is going to be one of the major issues in that kind of mid of the continent. Climate change there is felt double as heavy. And management, proper management of water irrigation, because right now with old post-Soviet, so to say, irrigation techniques, half of that water is just simply evaporating. So irrigation for, again, there where agriculture has a lot of potential is very important. Samuel mentioned another project, Svevint, that's a German-Swedish investment, which is planning to build enormous wind and solar green hydrogen production in the west of Kazakhstan. Being ninth largest country in the world, Kazakhstan has a lot of space, and there is a lot of wind, there is a lot of sun. Enormous potential. Question is how to bring that green energy to Europe. Part of that, of course, will be used by Kazakh industries to green steel, for example, or fertilizers. But the major part of that is meant to go to Europe. Do you export green electricity? You need cables. Do you export ammonia? And for that, for example, both ports, Kurik and Aktau, on the Caspian Sea, are crucial, because so far I think ammonia is one of the preferred options of transportation. That is in a few years to come. Because now this project of the solar and wind is only in the stage of feasibility studies, and some practical drillings and testings are starting. So in a couple of years, the amounts will constantly increase. And for that, you need port facilities. You need ships in the Caspian Sea, and you need to build ships. Now, with the Volga-Don Canal closed, you need to build in the sea. And that comes to Turkmenistan, to Kazakhstan, to Azerbaijan. None of them have a very big shipbuilding capacity, and that's another potential need for investments. But unless there are cargoes, it's very difficult to convince people to invest into building ships. Unless there are ships, there will be few entrepreneurs willing to kind of put and store their cargoes in the ports, just not knowing when they can be transported to the other shore. So both need to work together. And I would say another very important thing is because EBRD has already invested and it is investing in this Almaty bypass for the railroad, deepening of the Aktau and Kurik ports because Caspian water is now in the process of kind of getting down. You need dredging of this sea bottom there. Enlarging port facilities, you need more cranes for container handling. But very importantly right now is that the three countries along the route, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, have agreed a joint venture among their railways, and they promised to agree now on the single charter. Very important thing, which would give confidence and predictability for economic operators that they would know how quickly and at what cost their cargoes would be delivered from, let's say, Kazakhstan, Central Asia to European ports. And for that, you need also create something like a platform where customers could track the cargoes, submit electronic declarations for customs, for crossings, and make this intermodular, because it's a difficult route. You need to load to rails or wagons and then maybe trucks, ships several times. So you need a very well working management. And I wish that either we help the countries there in the region, or maybe there is a big European company with experience in doing that, which could come. And Minister of Transport of Kazakhstan has openly and now actively invited, and he's touring several European countries, inviting experienced cargo handling companies to come invest and help to manage that line.
Okay, thank you. A reminder, we're talking about the recent EU forum where a 10 billion euro investment and support package for Central Asia was announced. And my guests are Kęstutis Jankauskas, the EU ambassador to Kazakhstan, and Samuel Dobry-Vesterby, director of the European Neighborhood Council. Thanks again for being on the show to both of you. Samuel, let's talk about what is going to come from Central Asia and go to Europe, because I know that critical raw materials was a big topic at this forum. So can you talk a little bit about that? And also, I want to refer specifically to something you wrote last week in an article where you're talking about Uzbekistan. And you said that part of the Global Gateway aims to turn Uzbekistan into an industrial supply chain hub for raw materials in high demand like uranium, lithium, titanium, and copper. So can you talk a little bit about critical raw materials and getting them from Central Asia to Europe, please?
Yeah, with pleasure. There's a very, very important component of the EU's Central Asia strategy, which is linked to critical raw materials. For a prolonged period of time, the EU has relied on critical raw materials from very, very few borderline monopolistic sources. So essentially, the critical raw materials, you know, moving from critical raw materials like boron or all the way down to, you know, uranium or other types like geranium or many other. There's so many critical raw materials and also other non-critical raw materials that are still very important for our supply chains. For a very long period of time, the EU was relying on few countries, namely China, but also a few others, in order to source those materials. These critical raw materials are essential for a range of different products. For example, eolic wind turbines, as Ambassador Jankauskas mentioned before, but also solar panels, our telephones, microchips, various types of consumer products, and so forth. And so they are very, very important in our supply chains, and they're very important in our economies. And so there are these two problems that we've been facing over the years. One of them, as I mentioned, is the fact that we have been sourcing them from very few clients or very, very few sources. And the other problem has been that we've been sourcing them often in countries that have very, very problematic labor and environmental standards. And so what Global Gateway has been trying to do is signing MOUs with, for example, Uzbekistan, but Kazakhstan is an equally important country when it comes to critical raw materials, precisely with the intention of being able to mine these critical raw materials and bring them to our supply chains in a in an environmentally and socially responsible way. And so this is a very interesting point because, I mean, I'm going to be brutally honest, when you look at European history for a long period of time, I think the general perception, and I think it reflects sadly a reality, is that empires and countries and colonial empires had the tendency to go to other countries, take their raw materials at whatever cost and in a very very unfair practice, and then bring them back and so forth. And so I think what the European Union is trying to do today is it's trying to say, listen, we need these raw materials, but we've implemented very strict laws, due diligence compliance laws that constrain our companies to be far more environmentally friendly and far more diligent with regards to things like child labor, with things like not using labor migration that's undeclared, not having discriminatory practices against women in the workplace, and so forth and so forth. And I think perhaps we don't have time to delve into it in that much detail, but I think it's worth mentioning on your show that a country like Germany has passed a legislation which is called the LKSG legislation on the 1st of January last year. And this legislation essentially penalizes any German company with a potential 2% annual turnover fine or penalty of a company's annual turnover. So that's potentially billions and billions. It fines it if there is evidence that along this company's supply chain there is a breach of environmental labor standards and so forth. And so that's, in short, quite revolutionizing in the sense that that's a way to guarantee that EU supply chains, not only in critical raw materials, but also in critical raw materials, also in textile, also in automotive, also in white goods and in other types of value chains, it kind of guarantees that there is a minimum labor standard and a minimum environmental standard. And so I think in the context of the EU's need for those critical raw materials in Central Asia, the EU and its member states have noticed that in Kazakhstan and in Uzbekistan, but also potentially in the other Central Asian republics, there are certain standards which can be upheld. There is a potential to find those critical raw materials, mine those critical raw materials, and bring them back through supply chains in a responsible way. And then with regards to your question on supply chain hubs, that's indeed an interesting it's an interesting point, because at the moment, a lot of the global gateway and a lot of the so-called middle corridor initiatives still view Central Asia as a type of transit area for goods, for critical raw materials, for energy. But when we look a little bit more long term, it also has a potential role as an actual supply chain hub. So, for example, a country like Uzbekistan, which is not necessarily on the traditional China-EU middle core trajectory, can also provide a type of critical raw material and general supply chain hub value to European economies. For example, let's say that there are certain types of critical raw material being mined in Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan. That process might lead to other industries that use the waste of the first industry to create new business, or sometimes there's spin-off businesses in supply chains that are created as a result of growth in connectivity and so forth. So I think it's very important to think about how Uzbekistan and the other Central Asian countries are not just a transit, but also a potential supply chain hub and a potential hub for new industry and for growth.
Thank you. And I should mention that due diligence was a big part of this forum and the talk that you had today, which was very reassuring, because I know a lot of people were concerned that $10 billion could just disappear into corrupt black holes of Central Asia. And before I leave critical raw materials, Master Jankauskas, Kazakhstan, of course, has some of these too. And I know that when they had the C5 in meeting in Germany last year, one of the key agreements that was signed was for a German company to set up an operation to mine and process lithium in Kazakhstan, for example. I think they're going to put up $500 million into that. Can you talk a little bit about Kazakhstan and critical raw materials and their interaction with the European Union?
Yes, Kazakhstan, if I'm not mistaken, was the third country in the world with which European Union has signed a special memorandum of understanding that was done by the President of the European Commission in November 22. That was in Sharm el-Sheikh at the COP27, if I'm not mistaken. So it's already some time since then. We have developed since then a concrete action plan. We have had two missions of European businesses, two different cities, Oskemen, Pavlodar, Astana in Kazakhstan, because Kazakhstan says that they have it all. They have very well set production of aluminum, copper, zinc, titanium, beryllium, and of course lithium is now becoming much more interesting for all of us. They are now probably the largest country in the world supplying uranium. And for example, France is one of the biggest consumers there. Huge potential and good timing, because Kazakhstan is looking for localizing the production right now, diminishing its dependence, which was there for decades from its northern neighbor, setting up its own production. And there is European interest in these metals, while Kazakhstan wants to diversify its own production. It has young and growing societies, so there is a workforce, basically pretty good education, and now also our cooperation is very, very active in kind of more work on education standards, and many of the countries and companies are also contributing to that. Kazakhstan wants European campuses of various universities to be open there. Erasmus Plus is the very popular program, and so on. So we have the legal basis in place. Kazakhstan has already signed this enhanced partnership and cooperation agreement with European Union, first of its kind in Central Asia. So there is legal base. And now with memorandum in place, with the action plan in place, we need companies. We need companies who would, first of all, come and do the exploration because, well, we know there is a lot, but most of these studies were still done back decades ago in Soviet times. So new methods, new ways of exploring so that companies would know exactly what there is. And yes, Kazakhstan wants, first of all, our companies, our technologies, modern technologies, green technologies to come to establish the production, and then of course we'll need that Trans-Caspian corridor to export the goods, import equipment, and here both Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan should actually team together, because for all five countries it's like, you know, a big river and the small flows, springs that feed into it. This Trans-Caspian corridor will take it and work it both ways. And there may be not one, but several hubs. And along these routes, along these hubs, definitely production can develop. There is a huge potential there. And I would use this podcast inviting European producers who would be interested to contact us, to come to Kazakhstan. There is already lots of work in place, and there could be much more.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm conscious of our time, and there's certainly a lot we could talk about, but I want to ask you both to respond to this one last question and take a few minutes to do so. There are several projects that are similar to Global Gateway, right? So there's Belt and Road Initiative. If we want to go back a little bit further, there's the Central Asia Regional Economic Cooperation Program. That's an Asian development program with corridors that go through Central Asia, the Trans-Caspian International Trade Route, the Lapis Lazuli Route, you know, the list goes on and on here. What is distinct? How does Global Gateway distinguish itself from those other programs? In what ways is it a little different? In what ways is it complementary to those other projects that are going on? And I'll start with you, Ambassador Jankauskas.
Well, Global Gateway is a European Union initiative. And it's not only about the transport, it's about much more, basically doing business in the sustainable way. That means that projects that we would be sponsoring and engaging into would not only bring a simple investment and put the railroad there, which is part of what we do, but it would bring it in the sustainable way, meaning bringing it the technologically advanced and green technologies. It would really make sure that the labor standards, for example, which Samuel talked about, would be respected, so European companies would not need to worry about violating any of these rules. I think our companies and our investors would come with a sanctions-aware mindset. So this angle, which also is important for European companies, that they would not be in any way involved in circumventing of those, in a way, thoughtful, green, sustainable way. Now, Belt and Road, well, for transport, the more connections there are, the better. Cargos will go, all of them. They will, businesses will choose what is fastest, what is cheapest, what is most reliable. And here, I think, in a way, our initiatives meet. If it's only the Central Asia, the market is around 80 million people. If our cargoes can cross the Central Asia China borders, the market there is much bigger. So potentially it's transit and the localization of industries in Central Asia and along the South Caucasus, which have been our partners for all three countries for decades. And Global Gateways has this other component because it unites the other projects. Samuel started with water management. It's inevitably there because if there's going to be no drinking water, not speaking of irrigations, I mean, there's going to be no life there in the desert. Secondly, for example, digital connectivity. To make this transport route sustainable, we need internet. We are now working within the Global Gateway for digital satellite connectivity project, providing Kazakhstan and other four countries in Central Asia with alternatives, because so far they're mainly hanging on one internet cable, so on and so on. I'm just illustrating that. You asked for a few minutes. I could expand more, but let me stop there.
Okay, thank you very much. Samuel, we'll give you the last word then. What's different about Global Gateway than these other projects?
Well, I mean, first, I think it's important to mention that Belt and Road Initiative has areas of complementarity. The trade that we're witnessing in large part is also between China and the EU, and China is a very important trading partner for the EU. And so the infrastructure that's been developed over the years by BRI or Belt and Road is very important, and it's helped develop road connection, dry ports, and various types of connectivity in the region, which today is also very helpful for the EU. But in addition to that, I think it's important to say that BRI and Global Gateway are fundamentally different. And we've discussed it a little bit before why there is this difference, but it's far beyond the communicative difference. It's a deeply structural difference. And it's based in the fact that the EU's Global Gateway, at its essence, is sustainable. And sustainable in the following way. As I mentioned before, when you have blending of multiple financial institutions, multiple member states, and private companies, as Ambassador Jankauskas mentioned, that have to be convinced to invest, that don't just jump because you tell them to do so. No, they have to be convinced. There has to be feasibility, impact assessment. Like, it's genuine, convincing, and evidence-based investment which is happening. And so that's pretty important when you look at sustainable investment, because it means that whatever these companies are investing in, they genuinely believe will function and work. So I think that's a very, very different, and in some kind of way, free marketeer mindset, which is more durable and more sustainable in terms of what they're investing in. And there's a guaranteed market behind it. So that means that it doesn't need government subsidies forever. In fact, on the contrary, it's likely to very much find its own legs and develop on its own. In addition, I think it's also very important to mention that Global Gateway has this regulatory transformative element to it, which you don't find in the other investment initiatives from other countries and regions. So what the EU's Global Gateway is doing is it says, you know, you can sign an agreement with the EU like the EPCA and these very, 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 very complex and very long trade agreements, which essentially allow for the countries to also change some of their trade practices, you know, switching to more effective ways of doing commerce, like, you know, digital e-customs or other types of quite transformative legislative changes, which essentially help the countries develop into middle-income countries. In the case of Kazakhstan, it's already the case, but it's very likely that we'll see countries like Uzbekistan essentially increase quite dramatically in GDP per capita because they're taking these big transformative steps as a result of the Global Gateway initiative. And so in that case, I think it's also worth mentioning the case of Turkey. I know that it's, of course, a slightly different case, but over the past, you know, several decades, the EU signed a customs union agreement with Turkey. It developed Turkey's infrastructure through something called TEN-T and through a lot of funds linked to something called the IPA funds and accession funds. And granted, it's not identical with the case of Central Asia, but there are some noticeable similarities. And so my prediction would be that if the Central Asian republics take Turkey as an example, there is this potential for a very regulatory transformative element to Global Gateway, which can help these societies develop economically and essentially become very important supply chain countries and also be able to benefit from a lot of technology transfer in their own right over the upcoming years. And that's something that goes both in line with, you know, kind of the more ethical, environmental, labor standard, you know, UN sustainability goals, but that also really benefits these countries in order to become, you know, more kind of sustainable, more autonomously producing, more important industrial centers that have economies in their own right that are not only these kind of transit countries, let's say. And then perhaps the last point, which is worth mentioning as well, is that when we look at, for example, some of the work that's been done on protest tracking and instability in the region, it's quite interesting. What we see is that in areas where there are climate problems or water scarcity, or even sometimes where there's been large-scale investment from investors that don't come from the EU, that have brought in, let's say, foreign labor and maybe have engaged in some types of land acquisition, it has often resulted in a lot of local animosity and a lot of labor animosity and a lot of protest as well, which is essentially something I think that many of the governments in the region, of course, fear and are not happy about. So they don't want that kind of instability. And so here, the Global Gateway essentially tries to have a more labor-friendly and environmentally friendly attitude legally towards local communities, precisely also with the goal of guaranteeing a more sustainable society of less instability, essentially.
Okay. Well, we could talk about this for a long time, and I hope I'm going to be able to invite you both back onto the show in the future, but so we can follow the progress of Global Gateway in Central Asia. But for now, we're out of time. So thank you, Samuel and Ambassador Jankauskas, for being on the program. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back soon. Bye-bye.